Hey y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson, and from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound, conversations with people from all walks of life about how the South shapes who they are and what they do. New song called Boom by Tennessee native Sierra Hall, who's been singing and playing mandolin on stage since she was in elementary school. She was the first woman to win the International Bluegrass Music Association's Mandolin Player of the Year Award, and now she's won it 6 times. More than 20 years into her music career, Hall is traveling beyond her bluegrass roots. She's played with Dave Matthews and Sturgill Simpson. She's covered songs from Tears for Fears and The Grateful Dead. All those influences come together on her new album, A Tiptoe High Wire, which comes out March 7th. Among other things, we talk about where that album title came from. It's a reference not just to her grandmother, but to the risks Hall is taking in her own musical career. Here's our conversation. Sierra Hall, I know you're getting ready to start a tour, and I've talked to a lot of musicians over the years about touring. Some of them say, oh boy, I get to go on a new tour. And some of them say, oh my God, I have to go back out on the road again. As you're getting ready to go back out, like where are you falling on that spectrum?
You know, I started touring when I was really young, like, you know, not nearly as much, of course, as I do now, because I was still a student and my parents would take me, you know, back in the day. But I mean, I first started traveling and playing shows as early as like 12 years old. So thinking back, it's kind of it's just a bit of a way of life for me. It's, you know, being on the move, traveling, performing has been something that's been kind of woven through my life story from the time I was quite young till now. So I do have this kind of kindred relationship with what it means to be traveling and the joys and woes of both things, I suppose. But I still do really love it. I mean, the older I get, the more I realize the value of getting to just be home, finding that quiet space, how sometimes the more success you have, which of course, you know, we all hope for and want, but the more success you have, the more opportunity it bodes too. And then the more time, you know, and commitments you get if you're saying yes to a lot of those things. So I found myself, you know, having a lot of really wonderful opportunities over the last few years that, you know, you have a hard time going, well, of course, why wouldn't I want to go do that thing? Why wouldn't I want to go do that thing? But sort of finding myself trying to really prioritize, well, what are the things I'm focused on in this moment and what things, you know, can I say yes to and still make sure that I'm carving out a little time to be able to be home and have that quiet time, because I do feel like creativity comes from those quiet moments. And if you're just always in motion, at least for me, when you're always in motion and I'm always on the go, sometimes it's hard to even have time to just, you know, sit there and dream up the next thing.
So I looked up a bunch of clips of you playing live. You played everywhere from like clubs to festivals to theaters to, I saw one clip of you, I think somewhere in Mexico, playing in what looked like in front of like a giant swimming pool.
Oh yeah.
With everybody just kind of bobbing around.
That was just a couple weeks ago.
Oh, was it? Okay. So I'm wondering, when you're getting ready to go out, how you calibrate what you're going to play in a given set, depending on what the venue is and what you think the audience is going to be like.
Well, it's funny because I just was talking to somebody else about this, that was kind of asking a similar question. And I said, I think that like, it's interesting because you can go into something thinking, well, this is what I anticipate the audience to be like. You know, I am fortunate, I think, that I get to play a lot of variety of venues. You know, there's something perhaps easier and more comforting if in some ways if you were just able to go, cool, I know this is the kind of similar size room I play. Like I only play PACs at this size, and this is what our show is always like. Same thing, or if you're like, I always play standing room venues and the show energy is always like this, you know. But I feel like I get a wide variety of things, and I love that because I feel like musically I'm interested in a wide variety of things. So if you go and you play a standing room crowd where the audience is right here and they're giving you all this like energy back and they're lively oftentimes, that's a different kind of experience putting on a show in a room like that than it is if an audience is seated and maybe they may be equally enjoying the show, but what they give you back is different. You know, you might have more quieter moments you feel like you can lean into in a show like that where you can hear a pin drop. You know, a festival crowd, you know, outside, if you're playing earlier in the day and the sun's beating down, it may determine the kind of set list you put together for an audience, kind of trying to meet the audience where they're at, if that makes sense. But I also think, I can't tell you how many times that I think a particular show is going to feel this way or go this way, and the audience surprises you.
As you said, you've been playing for a long time, done a lot of shows. Do you have one that is sort of a legendary disaster for whatever reason? Something that you look back on and sort of laugh about now, but at the time it was just like everything just blew up somehow?
Oh, more than a show, we just had a tour that was a legendary disaster in the travel side of it back in September, like one for the memoir. And we don't even have time on this interview for me to tell you everything that happened. The show, somehow, I have to say, it was a really beautiful realization with myself and our band and our team that, like, even in the midst of like kind of chaos and all the things that can go wrong being on tour, that like it felt like we were all resilient enough to get through it with a smile on our face and still enjoy the fun part of the gig, which is making music. But we had like three bus breakdowns. Our bass player got the norovirus and got really sick, and we had to like, you know, separate from him and fly in a sub for a couple shows. We did a show without bass on one show, and again, kind of like talking about adapting, where we were playing more of a listening room, which kind of thankfully lent itself to that more than, say, if it had been a festival. But like, where I just chose to do the whole show seated. We didn't do it with bass, so we sat down. Normally, you know, we're just standing performing like you would expect, but we sort of built a living room vibe with just our lights and different things. And I took requests for the whole show. I mean, like, we played maybe one song, and then I was literally like, what do you guys want to hear tonight? And whether my band boys knew it or not, we did it. And they can kind of jump in, but I was like, cool, you want to hear that song off this record? You got it. And it was really special. It was really fun. And sometimes the chaos can like lead to, you know, it's funny when you look back at it and you go, man, that was crazy. But it just, from the moment that our bus, we were waiting, you know, normally you load up on a bus tour the night before your show around, you know, 11 or midnight, depending on how far the first show is away. Sleep overnight on the bus and wake up in the city that your show is at. So it was like 11 o'clock at night, and we're sitting there waiting on the bus, and we're like, the bus is running late. And so my tour manager, you know, reaches out. The bus company says, yeah, the driver just had to pull over. He thinks there's something going on with the bus. He's not sure what it is. Thinks it's a simple fix, but it's probably going to be tomorrow before we can get it in the shop and get the part and all that stuff. So we ended up having to book last minute flights. We were at the airport like 5 hours later to fly to this place we needed to get, rent a car, drive a couple hours to get there. And it was just like comical, you know, again, just some of the things that can go wrong that's completely out of your control.
This new album, A Tiptoe High Wire, that's a lyric from this song on the album called Spitfire.
She's a spitfire, spitfire, tougher than thorns on a briar. And you really can't blame her if she's easy to anger. Oh, she's a spitfire.
To my understanding, and you could tell me more about this, is about your grandmother, is that right?
Yeah, it is. So, I mean, the song never explicitly says, you know, that it's about my granny, but I think if you listen closely, you'll know that it's someone that matters to me. And there's a lyric at the end that says, "She's in my blood," you know. So she passed away a couple years ago, almost now. May will be 2 years since we lost her, but was just one of the most resilient, beautiful women I've ever known. So lucky to have her as my granny. And you know, she was 80 years old when she passed, but man, she lived a lot of life in those 80 years, growing up super poor in the hills of Tennessee. The sort of lyrics in the song tell some stories about her life and loss and, you know, tragedies she went through. But when I think of her as this beautiful, fiery woman. You know, I laugh and say, well, the song Spitfire, she probably would have said Spitfire instead of Spitfire. But yeah, she just, you know, would go to the ends of the world and you know, love you through anything. And so when I thought about this new record and I kept thinking what the title of this album should be, there's also a song on the record called Redbird that I didn't write thinking about my granny, but now that she's passed, it's like she loved Redbird, so I can't help but think of her when I sing that song now. And a couple references throughout the record to my husband's grandmothers as well. So it's like this record, when I think about sort of the strong woman influence that so many of us have, not just me, you know, the song Spitfire is kind of like talking about someone's life and the resilience on the other side and how you know, you can survive kind of almost anything, you know, that when you think you can't. And so I've found a lot of inspiration in that. And when thinking about like the title of the record, there's a song on there, Queen of a Tiptoe High Wire. And I just thought, well, you know, this place that I'm in right now, this is my first independent release. It's the first time in my career that I'm sort of stepping into this territory. I think of this record being the first album I've put out in 5 years, although that I've kind of learned and grown through those 5 years of collaborating with different people, the things that, you know, the inspiration I bring back to my own music through those kind of experiences. And while at the same time, just being born and raised Tennessean that grew up a bluegrass gal, I love pushing the boundaries and exploring what can be done on my instrument and through songwriting. And so kind of feeling like I was like stepping out onto this high wire and into this thing. The image of that just felt emotionally like it made so much sense to me, while also thinking about how resilient my grandmother was in times of things that scare you a little bit, but how you push forward and you have to keep going and you come out of it with a smile on the other side.
Like you said, this is first independent release. Maybe you're trying some new things musically here. It sounds like it felt like a risk, certainly before you started. Now that the record's done and all that sort of thing, does it still feel risky to you? Does this still feel like you're wandering out on the wire, so to speak?
I think having a career doing the thing you love because you hold it so precious always feels a little like that, you know, inevitably. But I will say, like, as I've gotten older, you know, I've been doing this a long time now. I started so young, and one of the things that I've sort of talked about lately, and it kind of dawned on me recently, is that this is my first independent release, you know, at this level. But like going back, I signed with Rounder Records when I was so young. I was 13 when I signed my record deal with them, and all my albums have been released through them thus far. And it wasn't negative split or anything. We just fulfilled our end of the contracts. You know, it's like I put out the records, they did their part, and I looked up and was like, okay, I don't think I'm ready to re-sign with anyone. Nothing against Rounder, I needed a minute to kind of go, I'm in a different place than I was as a 13-year-old kid dreaming of being on Rounder. I mean, that was the label I dreamed of being on, and what a blessing to have been able to do that, you know, in my career. And I'm so grateful for that. But it's a very different landscape now in the music business than it was when I was a kid. I'm in a different place in my career and as an adult than I would have been then. So it felt kind of like I owed it to myself. Whereas a lot of people, I think, get the independent experience first and then hope to get signed by a label. They've kind of already had the moment to do the independent thing. I've never got to do that, you know? So this is very new for me and kind of empowering to be in a situation. I'm really grateful to have a wonderful team around me to kind of help me facilitate all those things. So yeah, it inevitably is a little bit scary, but I feel like it's all been going really well, and it's an exciting moment to to just feel empowered and be in ownership of my music in a way that I haven't previously felt.
I listened to an interview with you at some point where you talked about when you started out as a mandolin player, you know, playing in a lot of bands and stuff. A part of the mandolin in bluegrass, as you know, is to kind of be like the snare drum, like the
Exactly.
little chop sound in the background when you're not soloing. When you kind of came to the forefront and you're the band leader, so to speak, you had to learn to play a lot of fills and stuff because more was, I guess, kind of expected of you as a person who was more out front. I guess this leads to the question I want to ask is, how do you feel like you've kind of grown as a player, as someone who, you know, started out playing in a lot of ensemble stuff, but now you're kind of the front person, even though you're playing as part of a band?
You know, early on, I was in the bluegrass, or when I released my first couple records, I was had more of a traditional bluegrass band with, you know, banjo, fiddle, guitar, upright bass, mandolin. The song structure of a lot of those songs kind of landed a bit more in that bluegrass form, where the mandolin has a particular role in the bluegrass ensemble, like what you're talking about. I think really what made me start to think about the way my instrument and my voice interact and the sort of putting things at the forefront was when I made a record called Weighted Mind, and that record is primarily mandolin and voice. I used some octave mandolin as well. Great bass player that joined me on that record, Ethan Yojevitz. So when you kind of stripped away the band format that I had always known, that was a bit of a safety blanket where I'm just like playing the role of the mandolin, trying to tastefully do what the mandolin does in that situation. It wasn't so much about like, well, now I want to strip all this away just so I can, you know, be more featured. But it was more about like, how can I, if nothing is there, what does that sound like? How can I interweave my mandolin and my voice in a way that the two things can support one another? You know, if there's not a guitar there, if there's not a fiddle there, there's no banjo, what happens, you know? And at the time, my song structure that I, the way I was writing songs felt a little bit more broad and open, not as confined to like your traditional verse chorus solo song structure, if that makes sense. So that really that started to open up some ideas and really challenge me to think about what my instrument and what I like as an instrumentalist, what I could be capable of shaping, you know, in that way. And so I think I've kind of carried that throughout the last two records, really, but by adding the band back in, there's these moments where it's like I can kind of relax into the nest and the safety of the band and enjoy the contributions of what all these guys bring, but also making sure that like I'm not putting myself in a box musically either, that I'm still allowing myself the freedom to have the mandolin be whatever role it wants to be rather than what we sort of traditionally think it is.
Well, speaking of the traditional role, I think the other thing about the mandolin, especially in sort of the bluegrass format, is that the mandolin players are sort of like the Eddie Van Halens of bluegrass. Like, the best ones can really shred, and you can definitely do that. Do you still really enjoy doing those really fast runs? And do you feel like the audience, you know, I do a show, they're kind of expecting me to lay it out there a couple of times per show, that sort of thing?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's kind of like built into a bit of what bluegrass does, you know? I mean, it's a really beautiful, lonesome style of music, you know? You hear some really like heart-wrenching, amazing stuff built on a lot of beautiful harmony singing and you know, real depth, but there's a lot of bluegrass that it's just a joy to it's a good bed for being able to really pick, you know, as they say, and let the instrument shine and you know, the instrumental tunes, you know, they are often played with a lot of speed. I think it's a great training ground to grow up so immersed in that, where the style of music maybe kind of sounds simple at times, but actually requires a lot of dexterity to play it well, and a lot of practice, you know, a lot of really learning mechanics of your instrument and things like that. Yeah, I mean, I think growing up in that, naturally that became something that I spent a lot of time doing, playing instrumental music, and being a mandolin player has always been a huge focus and a huge part of what I do. So I do think, yeah, there's a certain amount of people expect to hear some of that, you know, when they come see me play. I think there's been times where I've thought, because I also just love writing and I love good songs, whether they're great songs to shred all over or play hot solos over or not. So I've always tried to kind of go, well, where's the balance where I can kind of, you know, do something that feels authentic and be able to have room for that part of myself that is an instrumentalist and loves to have that be a part of what I'm doing, as well as these amazing musicians that I have on stage with me and throughout this record, to allow their lights to shine as well, but to have our moments to, like, also just, you know, make sure that first and foremost the song has substance, you know. And I think in an ideal world you can find ways to marry those two worlds and have a variety of things that people can enjoy.
When we come back, Sierra Hall talks about getting into the right frame of mind for a solo.
There's always something really exciting and beautiful about those moments when you can just feel that free to do it.
That and more ahead on Southbound. Before we get back to this episode, I wanted to ask for a little help with something. If you enjoy Southbound, please give us a good rating and write us a review on Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast provider you have that allows such things. The more reviews and better ratings we get, the better chance there is that other listeners can find us. But to be honest, I'd just as soon you tell people about Southbound through good old word of mouth. If you could recommend it to just one person you know, somebody you might think would enjoy interesting conversations about the South, I'd be deeply grateful. If you have any thoughts about the show, guests to recommend, or anything that you think might make Southbound better, you can email me at ttomlinson@wfae.org. Thanks so much for giving us a little bit of your time. And now, back to my conversation with Sierra Hall. I do want to ask one more question about solos, because they always have been fascinating to me. When you're playing one, does your brain know where you're going at all? Or are you just like in some sort of state where you surprise yourself as to what you're playing?
A lot of surprising yourself, but I also think that every time is different. You know, talking about every audience being different, everything that you have to offer from day to day is different too. You know, it's like as artists, we have our moments where, of course, you have your structure. You may have things that you say similarly on stage every time, or certain kind of ways. You know, there's certain songs that I may play the solo the same way every time, because maybe it doesn't need a solo with a lot of meandering. Maybe there's something very to the point, beautiful, that just needs to be what it is. You know, I have songs that feel that way to me, that I'm perfectly happy to play something similar to the record every time. But then there's songs where, like, they're just asking to be explored, you know? And so then you can open up those moments to stretch things out. Naturally, as a musician, you play long enough, you have certain things in your musical language that you expect from yourself. But I think when there's those moments where you can really get so inside of it that you're not thinking at all, that you can surprise yourself on what comes out. And a lot of times that is just, you know, being able to tap into that energy of a moment. There's always something really exciting and beautiful about those moments when you can just feel that free to do it, which doesn't always happen, but that's, I think, as musicians, what we're searching for a lot of times, being able to almost be playing your instrument or singing or performing in a way that you can almost kind of like remove yourself from the performance and almost listen.
I want to ask about a couple of covers that you've put out one way or another over the last couple of years. Black Muddy River, that Grateful Dead song. How did you come across that? Are you a deadhead of sorts, or how did you end up deciding to play that?
I am more so now. Back then, when I that was the song that kind of made me go, oh, okay, the Grateful Dead also does this. Because, like, you know, as a bluegrass kid, I grew up more in the traditional scene, I guess, where when I would go to jams, the old timers were more playing like, you know, Flatt & Scruggs, Bill Monroe, maybe some Larry Sparks. You know, you might occasionally get a Tony Rice song or something, but it was more like first generation bluegrass stuff, you know, Reno and Smiley, Stanley Brothers, that kind of stuff. So I didn't know so much of the Grateful Dead music, but then of course, you know, over the last 10, 15 years, whatever, the jam scene, kind of what we think of the more progressive bluegrass jam scene and the traditional scene have kind of met in the middle a little bit more. So I feel like there's this, a little bit more of an easy bridge to get over here and sort of experience this other sort of bluegrass subgenre, so to speak. And I think a lot of the music of the Grateful Dead has found its way into that world. And so a lot of these songs I started hearing before I really realized they were Grateful Dead songs, similarly to how I would have probably known a ton of Bill Monroe songs or Flatt & Scruggs songs from the jams, just participating and playing the song, but maybe not really knowing who the original was, you know, because they're so beloved and covered by so many people. So a lot of the music from the Grateful Dead I'd heard was, you know, there's so much of it out there with the live recordings and things like that, that I had just, of course, heard it, but kind of thought I kind of knew what the vibe was, but I had never really dove into any of the recordings, like the studio recordings. And then I got invited to be part of this Grateful Dead tribute, and they asked me if I would sing a song in Asheville, North Carolina at this show that I was a part of. And so I said, okay. And they're like, yeah, whatever you want to do, just let us know. And so I just went on a listening journey. I thought, well, now is the time for me to finally dive in, because I obviously, this music must deserve it because everybody's obsessed with it. You know what I mean? But I'm kind of one, I'm not really that easy to just jump on the bandwagon just because everybody says they love something. You know, if I'm not authentically feeling it, I just can't, or not even authentically feeling it. Let's just say I've not really given it the time it deserves. They may be, you know, there's a lot of artists that I know are amazing, but I can't say I've dug into their catalog, and I might be like, well, yeah, I like that, but I don't really know their songs, you know? So I don't want to like pretend, oh yeah, I'm a deadhead, you know, when I don't really know that much of the songs. So I thought, okay, well, now's time for me to really like get in here and do my homework. So I started listening and diving into some of the studio recordings, and I heard Black Muddy River and I fell in love with that song. And so I sang the song on that tribute set maybe, gosh, 10 years ago. And it's just been one I've always really loved. I say that was the song that kind of like, I think really made me go, okay, well, now I get it.
The other one I want to ask about is Mad World, the Tears for Fears song that you've recorded and done. I've seen a couple of live YouTube performances that millions of people have seen.
And I find it kind of funny, I find it kind of sad, the dreams in which I'm dying are the best I've ever had. I find it hard to tell you, I find it hard to take, when people run in circles, it's a very, very
a song that I would not have listened to in the past and thought, oh, somebody should play this with bluegrass instruments. And so I'm wondering maybe about that song in particular, but just more broadly, as you're listening to music out in the world, do you hear something and go, oh, we could do something with that?
Sometimes, yeah. Sometimes it hits. And then sometimes you immediately recognize it, but then sometimes a song kind of just lands in your world at a particular time, and then you kind of can't get it out of your head, you know? And that happened to me with Mad World. I tuned into I was traveling somewhere, and there was an Easter celebration that was happening, I think, in New Orleans, that like Tyler Perry or somebody like that, the actor Tyler Perry was a producer, was was hosting this thing in New Orleans. And I think if my memory even serves me right, I just was in a hotel. I like never turn the TV on. I'm not a big TV person necessarily, so I rarely just turn it on if I'm in a hotel room. But I had a night off or something. For some reason, I turned the TV on, and there was this on one of the major network television stations, like ABC or NBC or something like that. A bunch of performers were just performing various things, and the artist Seal, goes by Seal, he sang Mad World. And I only, like, when I turned it on, and I think it might have been like in the middle of it, or I was doing something. I just remember kind of, doing one of those, that song. Yeah, that's a cool song. How do I know that song? But it's like, you know it, but you don't know how you know it. And so I was just like, it just kind of like got stuck in my head. And then I was thinking about it, and I was like, oh yeah, that Tears for Fears song. And then there's the Gary Jules version, which is also very famous from the movie soundtrack. So I knew I had heard the song, but I couldn't really remember why. And then I went and I did a few shows with and some recording with my friend Ron Block in the UK. And we stayed at this Airbnb, and I'm in like Leeds, England, or somewhere like that. And I look in the living room of this house that we're staying in, and there's a piano, and there's a book of songs, and the book is open to Mad World. And I was like, this song, that's the song. And I kept it kind of following me around until finally I was like, well, gosh, so then I just, how it is, you recognize something, or you think, oh, I don't really know this song, and then you hear it everywhere. Like, I have that happen sometimes. Somebody will say, have you seen this? And you're like, I don't know. And then all of a sudden it's like every other day you're seeing the thing. And so yeah, I just had my mandolin and was like, man, that melody's so cool. And then just thought it sounded so nice on the instrument, and eventually learned the words, and was just like, I just really fell in love with the song, and started covering it. And then fans, started requesting it, and finally we're like, when are you going to record this? Both that one and Black Muddy River, we heard that a lot after we started covering it. Some people would be like, oh, do you have that recorded? And we're like, no. And people go, oh, please, please record it. And so finally we went, okay, we're gonna go in the studio and record a couple of our favorite songs that we often do in our live set.
The other side project I wanted to ask you about is the time you spent with Sturgill Simpson playing on his bluegrass records. I'm no expert. That sounded like the greatest bluegrass band I've ever heard. Just those two records, both of them are amazing. There's one thing in particular I want to ask you about, though. One of the songs you'll play and you do a beautiful solo on is that song, I Don't Mind.
I'm alone. If you think you can never love me again, please go ahead, I don't mind. Oh no.
Which is a song that, and I know I'm not the only one because I've heard other people say this, like I get choked up every time I hear it. Because it's so sad, and so there's such a longing at the center of it. Are you able to separate yourself as a performer? Like when you're playing a really sad song, does it like get to you as you're playing it too?
Oh, it depends on the moment sometimes, gosh, I mean, especially as a woman over here, I cry pretty easily, I like to think of myself as a tough lady, but I might cry at a Super Bowl commercial, like happy tears. I'm easily moved by things, especially like extra happy stuff. I'm like, oh, can't take it. But no, there's definitely moments like that where, I think sometimes in the midst of recording, you can be in such a frame of mind where, we're trying to support the song and trying to make sure we know the song. And I mean, those records were made quickly. It was almost like being part of a big jam session, which is what they wanted it to feel like. But they brought in this incredible band to that can, learn stuff quickly and put it all together quickly. In some cases, we did these bluegrass versions of all his kind of existing songs. So some of them, a few of them I recognized and already knew, but that wasn't one I knew. And I remember being like, not just with that one, honestly, though, he's got so many good songs. There was a lot of stuff that again, kind of like, it's funny, you're talking about the Grateful Dead kind of not jumping on the bandwagon until you really feel like you have earned the right to say I'm a fan, if that makes sense. I remember seeing Sturgill play at a festival called High Sierra Music Festival out in California, like right before he kind of exploded. And I was probably 17, 18. I was pretty young at the time. And I remember me and my band at the time, like watching his set and being like, man, these guys are awesome. This is really great. And so I knew I was a fan, but I didn't like know his entire catalog, or you can know you're a fan, but when you get up close to things, again, it's kind of like doing the deep dive, listening to the dead. When you get up close to things and being in the studio, in this case, was that for me with him and just hearing. I mean, the first record, what we recorded, 19 or 20 songs, something like that. And then another, slew of songs for the second project. He's such a great writer. The depth of the material is both fun, quirky, but really deep at times too, which is what you hope to get, I think, out of music, to have that nice balance of things,
I want to kind of end up by taking you back to the very beginning. Do you remember the first time you picked up a mandolin?
I do.
So tell me about it.
I was 8 years old. I had got a fiddle for Christmas. My dad was starting to learn to play guitar a little bit. Like, he was already playing chords, and my brother and I grew up singing in church, and my dad would back us up on guitar. And I had a my great uncle on my mom's side was kind of like a another grandpa, to me. My aunt and uncle living right there, they were like grandparents. My grannies, the granny we were talking about was Spitfire. It's her older sister and her husband that I grew up right next door to. And so, because he was always playing mandolin or fiddle, not super virtuosic, but like, would always just be playing little old time tunes or hymns, things like that, Wildwood Flower, stuff like that on the guitar, the instruments weren't foreign to me. I mean, music in that kind of way, that casual way, was already kind of part of my life and the soundtrack of my childhood. But then my dad learning really started to get him excited about bluegrass. He got like a Larry Sparks tape, and he started getting my brother excited about it. So I think just because we were in this musical moment, my brother was starting to learn. My granny said, how would you like to play the fiddle? And I was like, sure. I kind of wanted to do whatever my brother was doing, so I thought, well, he's learning to play a little bit, I guess I will too, why not? So my granny and my great aunt and uncle got me this fiddle for Christmas, which was exciting, but it was a full size. And I was 8 years old, and I've always been a fairly petite person anyway, but I was really tiny back then. And by the time I reached my arm all the way out, I couldn't get there. So it was obvious I wasn't going to be able to really play this fiddle. But the mandolin is tuned like the fiddle. So the mandolin has 8 strings, but tuned in pairs. So it's the same, A, E, D, G from highest to lowest. And so my dad said, he had just got a mandolin himself and was trying to learn to play a little bit. I'd already been playing some guitar. So he said, well, how about I show you a tune on the mandolin, and you'll at least know where the notes are underneath your left hand, because the tuning is the same. But of course, you got frets. You don't have that on the fiddle. You got a pick. There's a bow with the fiddle. So he's like, of course, it'll be different, but at least if you kind of learn this, you'll get a little bit of head start. I'm sure it was just a way to keep me from being disappointed that I couldn't get started on my fiddle for that I got as my Christmas present. I think he taught me the tune "Bowl Them Cabbage Down." It's the way I remember it anyway. And I remember just right off the bat being like, "Wow, this is fun," and just feeling like, I don't know, it felt fairly natural and exciting to start learning something. So then later, I got a smaller fiddle, but I never really went to fiddle after that. Mandolin, probably because it was the first thing that I actually made music on, was like really just sparked this excitement at a moment in time to where I've kind of, as far back as I can remember now, always known this is what I wanted to do with my life since that moment. And I say since that moment, I mean maybe it took a little while for me to fully realize it, but I remember being really small and, somewhere in that 8 to 9 years old, knowing already at that point, like, I want to be a musician. This is what I want my life to be.
There's a deceptive ease to Sierra Hall's music that reminds me of one of her heroes, the the singer and fiddle player Allison Krauss. It's like a good bourbon. It goes down smooth, and only later do you feel the punch. They're also alike in that they're brilliant musicians who never feel like they're showing off. I've listened to Sierra's solo on Mad World probably 100 times now. It's one of those solos that feels like it has always belonged with that song in that moment. But it never comes off as flashy or attention-seeking. And I think of that as sort of a symbol for Sierra Hall herself. And if you make enough moments like that, you build a career that lasts a long, long time. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our editors are Eli Portillo and Jen Lang. Our main theme music comes from Joshua Lee Turner. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, the NPR app, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. Subscribe for free to get each new episode sent to you when it's ready. You can also find Southbound on our website. Just go to wfae.org/podcast/southbound. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.